We once asked you to join us as we talked about what could be hiding in the snow. Now we ask you to come along as we revisit one of those stories, because as you'll see, we just can't let it go.
Welcome to You Totally Made That Up. We are a bi-weekly history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up. But they're all true, and we especially like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, woo-woo elements, so those parts may only be true to the people who live them. We don't go for the lore says or the legend goes, though. We want dates and names and all the facts that we can find. Basically, we just like the weirdest and strangest stories from history. And I am Nash.
And I am Tiff. And you know, I just have to put it out there, you guys. I am so sorry for that Let It Go reference that was in the introduction there. Blame Nash. Just blame Nash. That was all. That was her. She made me do it.
And I'd say I was sorry, but I wouldn't mean it. And y'all.
That's true. That's totally true. So I guess just keep it to yourself if you're mad about it.
Yeah. No, but y'all will understand what that's about in a bit. But anyway, we are your hosts. We are not historians. We are merely researching and presenting you stories in a delightful way. We are also not podcasters who simply read from Wikipedia and giggle. So if that is your jam, we are not for you. But please do give us a go anyhow. And don't forget to keep listening after the episode's over to hear the outro, which will tell you how to get hold of us, where to find us on social media, because we love hearing from you. So, in episode 21, called Gloria's Drawers, we went over creepy stuff that may be hiding in the snow. And I talked about stuff related to Yetis, and Tiff covered the, and help me out here, Tiff, it's Dyatlov?
I think I said Dyatlov?
Okay.
I haven't practiced.
Dyatlov, Dyatlov, I've seen, but it's that. It's the Dyatlov Pass Mystery. And we thought about doing a spooky snack, which is one of our kind of shorty episodes, to tell you what we're about to cover. But to do so, we'd have to repeat what was already said. And so basically, what this is a re-release of Tiff's part, that just about Dyatlov. Then at the end, we're sharing a new part of the story, more information that's come up in the recent past. So, okay, refresh your memory on what we said, our theories and all that, then keep listening for the new stuff. Here we go.
So it's 9 students. They venture off into the wilderness. And then, spoiler alert, they're discovered dead when they don't check back in. It's like the perfect Hollywood plot. All right, so starting back at the beginning, it's Russia, 1959, and it's winter. We're going to start with Igor. So he's 23. He's getting ready to graduate, and he decides to plan this excursion. 190 miles through the Ural Mountains, ski hiking and camping. His mom tries to convince him not to go because he's supposed to be focusing on his thesis. And he's like, nah, I need the adventure. It's kind of one of those like one of those last spring break trips before you graduate and have to start being an adult. So that you know who Igor was, he was highly intelligent and a very practical person. And he was eventually looking into getting into cosmonautics. He also built his own telescope. He was a really great mechanic. And he apparently chased off a bear with a geologist's hammer during another adventure. He's also very, very athletic and very experienced with these kind of outdoor long adventures. According to a CNN article, Peter Bartolome, a friend of his, said, "A year prior to the incident, we went to the subpolar Urals in an expedition where the conditions were much more difficult than his last venture. I've always characterized him as a wonderfully knowledgeable person, an athlete, always well-prepared. One could always rely on him." So I want to make sure that you know that these were not just a bunch of dumb college students being all like, hey, let's take off into the Russian wilderness in the middle of winter, completely unprepared. That's far from the case. According to one source, they didn't pack any alcohol, they didn't bring cigarettes. All of them were experienced outdoorsy type of people with grade 2 hiker certifications, including skiing experience. And completing this journey would have actually qualified them for grade 3 status, which was the highest certification available in the country at the time. And getting a little bit ahead here, there was one short documentary that stated that 4 of the members were drunk at the time of the incident, but none of my other sources seem to be on the same page. So I'm just going to dismiss that theory kind of right off the bat right here. So he had 9 people decide to join him on this journey, 7 men and 2 women. And they were all fellow students. There was Zenaida. She was from the same university and also his ex-girlfriend. Yuri Doroshenko, Alexander Kolovatov, Yuri Krivonishenko, Rustem Slobodin, Nicolas Thibault Brignol, Ludmila Dubanina, Yuri Yudin. And then last there was Semyon Zolotaryov. And all of the people involved.
Congratulations, by the way, getting through those names.
Thank you. And I have to tell you their names because I have to distinguish between things later on in the story. So I can't just brush over it.
Well, and you know, and hey, they're the victims here. So, you know, but it's tough for us, y'all. It's tough with these names. I'm so sorry. We try. We look things up and it still is going to come out garbled.
I'm doing my best here.
You did great. So,
well, thanks. So they're all in their 20s, except for Semyon, who is actually 38 and a World War II vet. They leave at the end of January, actually on the 25th, and they have to take several modes of transportation to even get to the area where they're going to start this ski trip. The plan was to make the journey and check in once they arrive back at their base camp by around February 12th. They don't get far before Yuri Yudin actually falls ill, and he had to leave the group and go back home. He was having issues with sciatica, and yeah, that would have totally sucked for 190 miles. So he leaves the group of 9 to continue on. By January 31st, they reach a valley at the base of a mountain, which was kind of a base camp area. They set it up for stored items for the return trip, and they were preparing to make it over the mountain pass. So this area, let me just kind of tell you what kind of place they were trekking through. The mountain that they were preparing to traverse was called Kolyat Siakal, which translated to Dead Mountain. And they were trying to get to Mount Ortortin, which apparently was mistranslated as Don't Go There, but actually means mountain with swirling winds. Neither one of those sounds great to me. The area is remote, and it still is to this day. Someone recreating the journey for one of my sources, he had modern snow protection and equipment, was using a snowmobile to get through, and he was even having a hard time. The area does have some indigenous inhabitants, the Mansi people, and they are reindeer herders who've been there for hundreds of years. And at this time in 1959, the area was also home to some Gulag prison camps. These camps cut and processed timber, and they were some kind of makeshift factories. The camp in this area had a reputation as one of the most atrocious and violent, and very few even tried to escape because it was in such a remote location and because of the harsh climate. So, hey, it's the ideal spot for a college student adventure.
Oh, God bless them.
And I just cannot imagine being like, hey, let's go camping. Because while they're out there, I mean, things are getting down to negative 30 overnight while they are skiing and camping. And that sounds terrible. That just sounds terrible.
No, it made me cold right now. Just thinking about it. I got cold.
But good for them. Good for them. They're athletic. They're young. They're hopeful. Good for them. And they're having a good time. We know a lot of the facts up until this point because they did keep diaries and journals. One of them was actually taking photos all along the journey. So there are facts. They made it to the base of Dead Mountain by January 31st. They got stalled because of a storm that came through, and they were dead by February 2nd. And so now this is where the real story kind of kicks in. A few weeks went by before there was even concern for their lives. And this is because they weren't expected to check in until around February 12th. A trip like this takes time. They gave them extra time because of the weather. But when they weren't heard from by February 20th, the relatives decided to start a search party. They were flown into the area via helicopter, and they started tracing the steps of the hikers. February 26th, they found the remains of the camp. And from here on out, it's honestly hard to keep track of all of the weird, but we are going to try. You may be familiar with this whole story because the base camp area is now named after the leader of the group. His full name was Igor Dyatlov, and the area that I'm talking about is now known to this day as Dyatlov's Pass. So the tent was found in sort of an odd place. They had set it up in a valley in between two more desirable camping spots. Why they stopped there is not clear, but it's assumed that they may have just gotten far enough that they didn't want to go back and set up camp behind them, but it was kind of an open valley area. When the tent was discovered, their possessions were still inside. Food was still sitting out as if they were in the middle of a meal. Clothing, shoes, sleeping bags, all of their gear, all still set up inside. And outside there were footprints which matched the number of people in the camping party. And the footprints were all orderly and neat. They weren't like the footprints of people who would be running or, you know, be panicked leaving the tent. And this is significant because of the condition of the tent. And it had been cut open from the inside.
So like instead of, I don't know that they had zippers on tents back then, but I guess ties. So instead of untying it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like they just cut their way out.
Yeah. And no one was in or around the tent. The next day, February 27th, was when they discovered the first bodies. There was a wooded area several hundred meters from the campsite, and it was assumed correctly that the hikers would go and try to seek out a shelter there since they had left the shelter of their tent. And it wasn't far into the area until they discovered the first two bodies, Yuri Doroshenko and Yuri Krivanishenko. They were found at the base of a cedar tree. They were wearing only their underwear, like think nightshirts, underoos, maybe a sock, and they were next to a small improvised campfire. The tree that they were under had been damaged from the base and up for about 5 meters, which is about 16 feet. But there was no knife recovered, and there are two ideas about the tree damage. One was that they had been tearing down branches to use for the fire and for protection, or that someone had scrambled up the tree to try and get away from something. The next set of bodies were found the same day, and those were the bodies of Igor and Zinaida. And they had similar issues that the Yuris did. Igor was wearing clothing, but no shoes. And Zinaida, she was better dressed. She had on two hats, a long sleeve undershirt, a sweater, a flannel, and another sweater that had been torn by the sleeve. She had on pants, trousers, ski pants, and some socks. But there were no boots, no footwear. March 5th was when they found Rustem Slobodan. He was buried under about 20 inches of snow. And he was wearing a good amount of clothing, but still not fully prepared for the elements. And he only had one felt boot on one foot. Now, the last four bodies were not discovered until May 5th. And they were found about 70 meters, which is about 230 feet, from where the other bodies were found by that cedar tree. They were discovered about 13 feet down in a ravine. And they had built themselves, or at least started to, try to build themselves a small den to protect themselves from the elements. Six of them were declared dead due to hypothermia, and the other three were dead from injuries, which makes sense. They're severely underdressed and exposed to the elements, and like I said, it got down to around negative 30. But a few things about the bodies and the positions that they were found in, as well as some other evidence, raise a lot of questions. Witnesses present at the discovery noted the color of the bodies. Both of the Yuris were noted to have miscolored hands and faces. They were described almost brick-like in color, so they were like a reddish-brown, very, very dark. Igor and Zinaida also had some of the same coloring, and then Alexander at the den was described to have some gray-green skin tinged with purple. A lot of them had very, very clear, very severe burn marks on their skin. Some of them had their hair burned off. There were burn marks on clothes. And all of the hikers had appeared to suffer from trauma. We're talking like bruises, abrasions, marks that indicated some defensive wounds. Specifically, Zinaida had bruises. And this is said a few times throughout all of the sources and the paperwork. She had bruises that appeared to be the result of a baton strike. Several of the hikers suffered massive trauma injuries, like comparable to a really bad car accident. We're talking skull fractures, broken ribs, internal hemorrhaging. Ludmila and Semyon were both missing their eyes, and Ludmila was missing her tongue. And it wasn't said that it was cut out or ripped out or chewed. The medical records simply say the tongue is missing. And it wasn't just her tongue, it was missing like all of the floor muscles in her mouth. Igor and Zenaida both were also positioned as if they were trying to crawl back to the campsite. And then the four bodies that were found in the little den area by the ravine, they were wearing their own clothes. You know, they had managed to have a few layers on, and they had worn scraps from others. There was evidence that clothes had been cut off and kind of wrapped around themselves. So it seemed like they had survived for some time, and they were kind of scavenging other clothes off of maybe those who weren't going to make it, those who were dying off. And speaking of the clothing, when tested, at least three of the items tested positive for high levels of radiation. So, I mean, it's just, you keep searching through all the bodies and you're just finding weirder and weirder and weirder things. And I mean, they did full autopsies. They looked into the stomach contents. They looked at toxicology, which, like I said, there was no proof that they had been drinking or had taken any other drugs. Inside of their stomachs, there was no evidence that, like, the eyes or the tongue had been ingested by anybody else in the party. By the end of May, the official investigation into the incident is closed, and the deaths are noted to be a result of a compelling natural force, which is insanely vague.
I was about to say, can you be a little more vague? What?
Yeah. So which aspect of this should we look into first? Let's start with some of the natural forces, the things that might immediately come to your mind because they're on a mountain. So you might think about an avalanche, but this is not likely. Apparently, they don't really occur a lot in the area. Plus, the footsteps of the hikers were all still visible. They weren't covered up, and the tent was still mostly intact. It had collapsed, but it was not swept down the way it would have been in a massive rush of snow. You know what I mean? Not pulled sideways. It was just collapsed top right. to bottom. Yeah. There's a theory that there was like ball lightning or severe lightning strikes in the area. And they may have been drawn out of their tent kind of ooh and ah at the lightning being so close, but then having been struck by lightning, which maybe could explain some of the burns. I don't know. It's a really big kind of eh on that one for me. We can talk about people being a cause for whatever this incident was. We know that there were at least two other groups that were in the woods. The Mansi people, the indigenous people of the area, and the prisoners of the Gulag. For both of them, it's really hard to buy into for a number of reasons. The first one is the footprints in the snow at the scene. It was very clear, and it's noted by pretty much all the sources, that the footprints that they found were matched in number to the number of hikers. They didn't find any extra footprints in the area. They did investigate it. The Mansi people were investigated a lot more than the prisoners. Valery Anyamov's dad, Nikolay, he actually assisted in the search, and he ended up relaying some stories about the suspicion against them. He says, Soviet investigators were convinced we Mansi must have killed them. So many people around here were arrested, and a woman from another village, who is no longer with us, used to say that the secret police tortured them. I don't know if that is true, but they were certainly interrogated for weeks. There are actually suspicions that still linger about the involvement of the indigenous people in this incident. There's a book that was published in 2015 that suggested that some of the hunters were high on magic mushrooms, and they thought that the students had veered onto like sacred land and went and killed them in a craze. But Valery dismisses that. He says, you know, if any of our people had been involved in the crime, we would have all been in prison because it was so cruel in that time. And in those days, people were executed by firing squad without investigation or trial. The prisoners were ruled out because there didn't seem to be any evidence or notice of any breakouts, and also because of the lack of sexual assaults against the women, because they said that they would not have been able to resist that, which is really gross, but okay.
They've got a point. I mean,
yeah. So there we go. So there's that. But keeping with some of the human-based causes, what about military testing? What about military involvement or even a secret rocket launch in the area? We're in the Cold War. We've got the space race. We've had the atomic bomb dropped. Plus, you know, there's the radiation in the clothing. And to some extent, the radiation can be explained. For that, you have to take into consideration who the hikers were. Alexander Kolovatov, he was actually studying nuclear physics. So there's reason to believe that he had had some exposure to radioactive materials. And Yuri Krivonoshenko actually had previously worked in a nuclear power plant. So, you know, there's a possibility that they had some exposure because of that. And that's why the clothes kind of gave off those readings. There's question about whether or not there was a radiation leak in the area. And why would it have only affected the 9 people who were camping and not the entire area? There was actually one source that did kind of look into that. And they pointed out that it is a large area, you know, if you look at it on a map and geographically. And so because it was so remote, there would not have been a lot of people that were aware of any kind of a leak. Apparently, at the time of the students' deaths, many animals and birds had been found dead. The local people were banned from using water from wells. And the Mansi people said that the reindeer herders were banned from the area and hunting was not allowed for about 4 years after the incident. There's not a whole lot else about that, though, because there's lots of secrets at this time. And it really, I mean, it really it snowballs from there. Good. I mean, there are so many theories. I mean, hundreds. We could spend hours looking into every single one. These range from they had an issue with the stove that was in the tent, which was actually Igor's own invention. And they said that it had caused a fire inside the tent, and that's why they had left, and they were confused because of smoke inhalation. There was a theory that they had drank melted snow that had been contaminated by either those magic mushrooms or by other radioactive materials, and it caused them to go crazy. There were orbs seen in the sky. So, you know, aliens.
No.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. And this is actually verified by a number of the Mansi people. They had said that they had seen these bright, like fiery kind of orange balls in the sky. And it was attributed to a possible alien abduction and testing. And then, of course, them being deposited back into the area. So that's a fun one, right?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
There's a theory I'm liking, but I'll hold off.
There's also the idea of going back to kind of the rocket launch and the secret government testing that they had wandered into something. They were actually taken to another location and tested on and murdered and then put back into the campsite to be discovered. Some of them are stretches. I'll admit it. Some of them really are out there. Some of them are not too bad. In 2019, Russian officials actually launched a new investigation into the incident. So they reopened it. And they narrowed down the possibilities to a small list of just 75. So.
Oh, just. Yeah. Oh, just.
Yeah. We could be here for a long time if I even just do a small bullet point on each one. They all have interesting bits to them. So, of course, I'll encourage you to go and check out show notes for my sources, which do list off a lot, not all 75. It is hard to track down all of those. But they do kind of narrow it down to 3 favorite theories. The first one, of course, would be like an avalanche or a snow slab that came down and confused them, causing them to leave the tent, thinking that they needed to get to safety elsewhere, and then, of course, not finding that safety. Then there's my 2 favorites. The first one, I'm going to say one of these I think is pretty solid. And then there's another one, which is just kind of wild and fun. And I'm going to let you guys judge which one is which and which one you think is most likely. But here we go.
It's me, the British text-to-speech guy, popping in to tell you there was lots of facetious Yeti talk here, but I am editing it. Yes, me. I edited it. The ladies went off the rails and it is obviously the stupidest of the theories. That, and the aliens. Okay, back to it.
The other theory that I want to touch on is called infrasound. So this is a naturally occurring phenomena, and I'm just going to read this from my source because it's explained very, very nicely. Due to the unique topography of Dead Mountain, which is a perfect dome shape, the fierce winds that blow through the pass could have been warped as they struck the blunt surface. The wind, which was blowing in a straight line, would be twisted into a series of small but powerful tornadoes, which would tear down either side of the pass. The tornadoes, spinning fast enough to tear the roofs off buildings, would have created a deafening noise. And even if it missed the tents, as a theory suggests, under certain circumstances, they could also produce a more subtle and terrifying phenomenon known as infrasound. It's the opposite of ultrasound. It is a type of vibration in the air which has a frequency so low it cannot be picked up by the human ear, but it can have marked effects on the human body, including a loss of sleep, shortness of breath, and extreme dread. Of course, none of the theories can fully explain all of the factors surrounding the deaths of the campers, but this infrasound theory really relies on kind of a perfect storm of conditions at the mountain. But it is interesting. You know, I mean, there are studies now about using sound waves as like weapons because it can have such interesting and horrible effects on the human body. So just imagine, like, it's dark, it's freezing, you're on this mountain, and all of a sudden something is just happening to your body that you just need to get out of there. So they cut it open to escape and get lost. I don't know. Like I said, 2019, the new investigation is launched, and there are actually some requests to exhume the bodies to examine them with modern technology, trying to catch what wouldn't have been seen back then or what wouldn't have been released. Pieces of evidence went missing during the initial investigation. When the documents were made public, a lot of the pages were actually missing or blank. Like there was a note from one of the witnesses that was there when they discovered the bodies that... Oh, and I can't remember who it was, which one of the students in the ravine actually had like a pad of paper with him. But that never showed up with the rest of the evidence. So we don't really know if he took notes while they were in the ravine or after their injuries, if he actually managed to record everything. There was the last picture that had been taken by the photographer on this trip, and it's really blurry. It looks like it's some weird kind of light thing. And it's unclear if they were taking pictures of those weird orbs that had been seen in the sky by the Mansi people, if he was trying to capture a photo of the lightning that may have been going on, if maybe he was taking pictures of a rocket that he wasn't supposed to see.
Quick question.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't let me throw you. The ones that had trauma, yes. Not, I mean, the significant trauma, I don't mean like scratches or whatever. Were the ones in the ravine, were they the ones that were found to have significant trauma? Or was it just a mishmash, like here and there and some, you know?
It gets worse kind of as you go further.
As they found them. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But when they get to the last four that were by the den by the ravine, I want to say that the one that was missing the tongue and the eyes, she was further down. She was down at the bottom at 13 feet.
I'm collecting information for my final judgment call. That's all.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. To this day, there's a nice little memorial plaque in the area that, of course, speaks to the tragedy that the students went through. But there's really no answer. There's no clear answer that anyone has proposed or agreed upon as to what happened to them and the significance of the burns or the radiation or the orbs in the sky, or really how it all connects. What do you think? What are you thinking? I want to know.
Oh, is it time for me to...
It's time. Tell me.
Okay. You don't want to go over what you think first?
No,
okay.
Go ahead.
All right.
Hello, it's me, the British text-to-speech guy. Nash is about to say CO2 about 5 million times. She didn't mean it. She means CO, or carbon monoxide. She knows the difference between carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, but it would be a real bitch to edit that in. Okay, back to her totally plausible theory.
I'm always a fan of the simplest explanation is probably the one to go with. So you talk about the injuries increasing in severity as, well, first off, I'd need to see actual real good solid, as good as it could have been in the 1950s, right?
1959.
So I'd have to, as good as they could have been, autopsy results, I'd have to see them. But they were clearly very warm in that tent. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been, with the exception of the couple of them that had on a decent amount of clothing, which that's me. I'm that girl. If I'm in cold weather and outside I'll never get quite comfortable enough to strip down to, you know, like just long sleeves and pants. So clearly it was very warm in that tent. And you talk about the stove, and that it was a homemade stove, and then how the guys that were found first, how they were very ruddy complected. Yes, radiation, I can see that, but that's going to have to be pretty tight in proximity to get that. My mind automatically goes to CO2. When I hear that people have been in a confined space with something that's generating heat, or just that's generating just a machine, whatever, my mind goes to CO2. And we talked about that, actually. Y'all look for the episode wherever Thelma Todd's in the description.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that, how people who die of carbon monoxide poisoning, sometimes they just, I mean, granted, these people were frozen aside, just coming upon somebody who's died of carbon monoxide poisoning, they might just look like they're asleep because the paleness that comes along with being dead is kind of counteracted by that ruddiness. And of course, windburn. I mean, hello. Then you talk about how the people in the ravine had the most trauma to them. And I think maybe some of them stumbled perhaps down into the ravine. I think the whole eyeball tongue thing is a scavenger situation, and perhaps just by a lone animal. Because otherwise, I feel like if it was a pack of animals of some sort, then more of the bodies would be missing. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? Like, but only, what'd you say? Two people had their eyes missing, and then that one girl also had her tongue missing.
Yeah.
So it could have been like just a pair of animals, and then whatever, something caused them to skitter off. Maybe the snow picked up or whatever. So there's also, and perhaps they realized that they were all feeling funky. And so they quickly somebody was like, we need to get out of here right now. And so they slice open the tent and everybody climbs out. And like you said, the footprints weren't all scattershot. Like everybody was dashing and running away like crazy. So if it was CO2, they'd have been groggy and kind of stumbling around, but not frantically going around. And then if they were all in states of, you know, they're mentally incapacitated, they would have wandered off. And there you go.
Yeah.
I can't explain the girl that it looked like somebody had whacked her. That I can't explain unless she'd had some kind of injury earlier in the day
mm-hmm.
of some sort, which I don't know what that injury could have been, but unless she fell against something while they were hiking, she slipped and fell against like branches or something while they were hiking. I don't know. And it could, I mean, you know, they could have all quickly, but see, here's the thing that gets me. It's the knife, using the knife to open the tent. That was either somebody panicked and said, we got to get out of here right now, or somebody wasn't in their right mind.
Mm-hmm. And then the knife was actually never recovered again. They found a knife sheath, but they couldn't find the knife that was apparently used to, like, you know, to open up the tent, to get down the branches. The branches were like torn off. It wasn't clear that they had been actually cut off with a tool. So there's question about where a weapon may have gone.
Well, okay, I have an idea about all that too.
Go for it.
Here's another explanation about the clothes. And I don't want to disparage the local folks. I'm just throwing this out there. If they came upon them and it was one of those situations of, well, they ain't using this stuff anymore, they could have taken clothes and some and those knives. They might not have gone to the extent of rummaging through the gear back at the camp, because that might have been a step too far. Or maybe other villagers were kind of approaching and they were like, shit, we better hurry and get the hell out of here. Now, I get that there were no other footprints found, but there was also a massive amount of snow. And we know that because they found bodies underneath
mm-hmm.
all the snow. And I'm also going to submit that I don't know how they could have definitively said, except for the area around the tent, right? There were only the 9 sets of footprints. Okay. Mm-hmm. But everywhere else, there's all these searchers and who knows who else. So there'd be no way to really discern between that and the snowfall if perhaps nearby village folk, if it was some of their footprints too, if they had come through, kind of taken some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
There is another theory that I did read about that thought that maybe a guard from the gulag had come across them and thought they were escaped prisoners and attacked them and beat them to death.
Nah.
You don't like the idea of them being taken away to a military testing facility and then placed back in the woods to appear as if they had frozen to death? No?
No. I'm down with whatever's simplest. And that's not to say that also, coincidentally, at the same time that there was a rocket test going on. And that's what people spotted in the sky. And maybe that's what prompted, again, here's the catch. Some might say, well, that's what prompted them to come out of the tent. Why'd they slice it open?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I keep coming back to. To me,
there's a strange mixture of panic and calm and confusion. Like, you know, obviously they're confused because they wandered away from their tent and it's correct. Unsure as to why they didn't go back. But they did have, you know, the mindset to be able to be like, oh, we need to find a shelter. And they went to the woods and they also got down branches to build themselves a little den. So it's just, that's part of why there's so many questions around the whole situation, was because were they confused? Were they not confused? Were they being chased? Were they trying to run from something? Was there even a lover's quarrel and one of them just went berserk and started attacking the others?
Well, going back to the CO2 thing, two of the groups started, like one started doing shelter and the other started doing a fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the two, Igor and the young lady whose name I can never remember. They were kind of stumbled away. It could be that they were closest to the stove, and so their exposure was worse. And that these other two groups, I mean, because that one group with the shelter, they got freaking far.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking they kind of started coming around and being like, oh, shit, but they're all turned around, and they don't know how to get back. So yeah. They had enough wherewithal once they got oxygenated again. And I'd have to look it up, but I don't even know if carboxyhemoglobin, if it would have been evident that far out from the deaths. I don't know if, you know what I'm saying? I don't know if that's like one of those tests that has to be done near immediately or what. If you've got like a window of a couple days or what.
Now, just to be a shit, what if I told you that when they came across the tent, they found that the stove not being used, like not assembled for use. So it appeared that either they had already used it and like taken it down, or they hadn't used it at all.
Well, then I would go for that they'd used it and take and broke it down, because you said there was food out.
And then they still had the exposure from before that.
And then because it takes a minute to kick in, is my point. It's why, you know, and it'll happen fast. Of course, the tinier the space, the quicker it happens. Tinier space and relative to how powerful whatever the thing is kicking out. But once it kicks in, hoo boy, it happens fast. So that would be my vote, is that they were doing their things. They did it. They broke it down. They were getting ready for bed. I don't know. That's my guess. But I have no idea. I'd have to, you know, again, the best answer is to exhume the bodies and give that a shot.
Yeah. And some of the family is not really happy about that option. They just want to, you know, let them rest in peace.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, that's a fucking mystery. You really don't want to know what happened?
Yeah. And I'm different. I'm of that ilk. I'm like, they're gone. So do what you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many different things that the weird, all the coincidences, all the weird little things that all happened at the exact same time that none of them necessarily point to a single solution.
Yeah. And it could be many. Yeah, exactly. It could be many things.
Mm-hmm. So that's my story about Diet Love Pass.
All right. So we had thoughts, obviously, and we talked about infrasound and carbon monoxide poisoning. And yes, also mentioned perhaps an avalanche. Like Tiff said, though, there didn't seem to be evidence of such, which brings us to the Disney movie Frozen. If you are somehow unfamiliar, if you somehow managed to dodge this absolute behemoth of a movie and the song Let It Go, and I will take time to formally apologize for making Tiff reference it. I do, but I could not, y'all. I could not. Come on. So, you may have heard recently, and by that I mean the past handful of months, because we're a touch behind the times, but you may have heard recently that Frozen, the movie, solved Diet Love. And, well, kinda. I mean, as you'll remember, I'm the Killjoy, so you may have guessed from my tone that I'm about to tell you that this isn't exactly true. I'm sorry, I know it's fun, I'm just not fun. And we do want to tell you this new part of the Diet Love story, because it's great, and it does involve Frozen. That part is true. First, though, If you somehow escape the clutches of this movie, which, don't come at me, y'all, I do not find it to be amongst the more superior of the Disney movies. I just don't, and for several reasons, but...
I just heard, like, a collective gasp from around the world.
Did you? Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think I did. I think so.
We had a little rant by me in our warm-up, so I'll save it. Maybe it'll... I'm planning on doing an outtakes mini-episode, so that might make the cut. I do not know, but I just... My reasons are myriad. But here's the basic plot line. For some reason, that's never really explained to my recollection, a little girl named Elsa, who happens to be a princess of a medieval-esque land in a Scandinavian-esque place, is discovered to have a special gift, and that gift is freezing stuff. She can manifest ice and snow and ice storms, all that stuff, and the issue is that she can't control the powers. She's hurt her sister accidentally in the past, and so she's got anxiety over that and keeps herself distant from the sister and, matter of fact, from everybody else. Then the parents die. Because Disney, and she has to take the throne. This stresses her out, and because, oh, poor woman and her fifis that she can't control, again, don't get me started on the reasons I don't like this movie, she flies off the handle, and her powers are discovered. Assholes call her names, or whatever, she runs off to isolate herself, creates an ice castle, blah blah blah, and in the process, she basically ice storms the kingdom, kind of wrecks it. The sister and some goofy dude go off to find her and be like, you gotta come back, the assholes are trying to take over, and by the way, can you dial back the snow because we're freezing our balls off over here. Shenanigans and attempted captures ensue, and point is, in and amongst all of this, there are some action scenes involving snow. And because animated movies are more or less done on computers nowadays, the animators can really drill down and get stuff to resemble real life. And in this case, one of those things included avalanches. So keep that tucked away. Now, quoting from National Geographic, in an article published today, and by today they meant January 28, 2021, in the journal Communications, Earth and Environment, researchers present data pointing to the likelihood that a bizarrely small, delayed avalanche may have been responsible. Now, Tiff had mentioned that Russian authorities had reopened the case, and this Nat Geo article tells us that they came to the conclusion that it was an avalanche that was responsible for the camper's deaths. However, quote, key scientific details were absent from the report, including a clear explanation as to how an avalanche could have taken place with no documented evidence of its occurrence left behind. And exactly, that's the question. That's the if, then. If avalanche, then where's the proof? Specifically, where was all the bajillion-ty tons of snow? Here's why.
Yeah, where? Where
yeah.
is it?
Exactly. Why? I mean, you know, that picture, one of the, I mean, y'all give it a Google, y'all, because we talked about this in past episodes. We're not posting pictures anymore, but there are pictures, and one of them is this tent that's kind of got snow piled on it, but it nothing dramatic. There is nothing dramatic about the campsite scene.
No, it's something that, it's an amount of snow that people could handle, especially people who were seasoned cross-country skiers like they were.
So, yeah, the campsite, I mean, you know, of course, finding bodies scattered everywhere, that was the dramatic, shocking part. But the campsite itself, not too much to say about that. But here's why. And before we come back to the movie Frozen, let's first get into a little more detail about the campsite. And Tiff touched on this, but let's recap briefly. It's on a fairly flat area in a valley of sorts. Don't picture like a valley. I just mean it's kind of dipped a touch. But there is a bit of a slope kind of above them, like they were kind of on the slope. So there's still slope above them, and it's described as mild. So you wouldn't think on glance that it would be prone to an avalanche, like something come rushing down. Rolling atop them at the bottom of this slope in this flat area. On top of this, there was zero snowfall documented on that night. And why is this important? Well, because the additional weight of snow would have made it like, oh yeah, it pressed down on what was already there and it caused it to slide. It's also pointed out in my sources that in terms of their injuries, they were kind of atypical of persons who died in an avalanche, whose usual cause of death would be asphyxiation. And I'm going to disagree here, or rather I'm just going to add on here, because I guess I do flat out disagree. There would be injury. There would likely be For example, the scraping of the icy parts and maybe rocks against skin. So you may have some superficial lacerations, definitely abrasions, because snow, anybody who's ever played in snow, if it's packed enough, you're going to come away with like...
It hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts. It gets rough.
Yeah, like a real sunburn-ish type of feel to it. And then to my mind, rather than suffocating in the snow, like in other words, it was blocking their airways, to me, it would be a crushing injury. So compressing their chest and then their lungs can't expand. And along with crushing injuries, you'd also, of course, expect maybe some broken bones, especially the ribs. But clearly, for the most part, they were mobile because we know the bodies were found away from the campsite. They weren't crushed in their tents right there on the spot. We know that. Okay, so moving on. But here's the major thing. When we say that the campsite was made on a fairly flat area, it was such because the group had cut into the packed snow below that slope to level it out. So it wasn't a totally natural valley type situation. Aha! And how I mentioned the slope was mild, it was really mild, like a 20 degree angle, it was estimated, which is, quote, well below the 30 degree incline that scientists will tell you it takes to trigger an avalanche. On top of that, for various reasons, and you can read more about them via the sources and show notes, we know the times of death, and we know about what time they set up camp, meaning we also know the time frame when they cut into the snow and ice. So put all the other stuff aside. This alone gives like a 9 to 11 hour spread, and if that cutting had triggered something, it should have happened immediately. Aha, again, this is still not serving the avalanche hypothesis, it would seem. Except, in that journal I mentioned earlier, two men named Johann Gahm and Alexander Puzrin proposed a phenomenon called a delayed slab avalanche. What is that? Glad you asked. Quote, when the year's first snow falls, it comes in contact with ground that's still relatively warm, but the air temperature has fallen dramatically, creating a temperature gradient that builds a porous, crystalline material known as a weak layer that's 80% air. Then on top of this, more snow falls, forming a dense slab. So in other words, it didn't necessarily need to snow that night in order to cause a slide. Now, the scientists I mentioned, they know their stuff. Puzrin is a geotechnical engineer at one of Switzerland's Federal Institutes of Technology, and Gahm is the head of the Snow Avalanche Simulation Laboratory at another Swiss Federal Technical Institute in Lausanne. They met around the time that 2019 Russian reopening of the case started, and both of them were most curious about the large delay between the setup of camp, the cutting into the snow and ice, and then the proposed avalanche. So they start working together to create models, aka computer simulations, to see if they could recreate some scenarios. And if you go to the Wired article that I have in show notes, you can see some of the simulations they ultimately came up with. They're really neat. They first wanted to determine the slope angle thing, the question being, was it actually only about 20 degrees? And turns out, no, it wasn't. Quote, the undulating topography of the mountain, undulating means having a smoothly rising and falling form or outline, just in case y'all don't know or have forgotten, but the undulating topography covered by snowfall made the slope appear mild, but it was actually closer to 30 degrees, the rule of thumb minimum requirement for many avalanches.
Gasp.
Did you just say gasp?
I just said gasp. Oh my God. The reveal, the dramatic reveal of that information.
And then they point out that when looking back on the original records at the time of the incident, it was noted that there was, quote, an underlying snow layer on the mountain that didn't clump together, providing a weak, slippery base that a lot of overlying snow could easily slide over. As Gahm says, were this a building, they essentially removed a retaining wall. Second thing, knowing that the cut they made likely destabilized things, the issue is that there had to be additional snow to cause a slide, like we talked about, but again, according to both weather reports and the campers' journals, no snowfall that day and night. However, something that was in the group's journals, some really strong wind. And these were super experienced outdoors people, as Tiff noted, so for them to take the time to write that down and to be like, hey, the wind, man, it had to have been something else, just to me.
Significant enough. Yeah.
They encountered wind all the time, blustery weather. I mean, that's par for the course for them.
Right, you're on a fucking mountain. It's going to be windy.
That maybe could have even been why they made camp early. Who knows? Because like Tiff talked about, they were supposed to be going and not a terrible amount of distance further. So it kind of struck everybody as weird. Well, why'd y'all stop and go on and make camp when you weren't all that far from your planned campsite stop? So that made me, I just wonder, that's my speculation. I just wonder if maybe this hard wind, they were like, look, we need to just buckle down for the night and not risk it. So why is this of import? One of my sources says that it was likely something called katabatic winds. Great word, katabatic. I love that. Which consists of these clumps of freezing air that carried not insignificant amounts of snow from higher up on the mountain down towards them. So as these clumps, as they are called, are gusting in, they're plopping this higher snow down in increments, which can explain all of those hours between the camp setup and the cutting in, and then the ultimate disaster. So our dudes have a pretty good idea of how this went down, and to the computers they go. What they find is that no, this wasn't some dramatic Michael Bay movie event. What the simulation showed is that all it would have taken was, quote, a block of icy matter a mere 16 feet long, about the size of an SUV. The small size explains why no evidence for an avalanche was found during the initial investigation. It would have infilled the cutout campsite before being quickly buried by fresh snowfall, because there was subsequent snowfall between the incident and when the search parties finally got up there. And quoting again, it would have been enough to fill the hole the campers had dug into the snow, but not enough that the rescue team would be able to find clear signs of an avalanche 26 days later. They'd likely think, and seems that they did, that it was just snowfall that had piled up over the almost month that it had taken them to get there. And so what do you think so far, Tiff?
That's a lot. It's just so specific. Just those elements happening together and needing to happen in such a way that it would make that avalanche and have that happen. Yeah, I don't know. And I'm still not sure about the bodies being where they were.
I'm so glad you bring that up. One of the things that they were looking at was, okay, so this is what we think happened, but does it explain the only real physical, it explains the physical evidence at the campsite, but there's tons more physical evidence in the form of the bodies that were spread out, you know, hell and gone from the campsite. And they wanted to look at, okay, if this is what we're proposing, could that have equaled the result of, you know, their injuries and their causes of death? So, all right. My sources go into how a seemingly small avalanche could cause such injuries. I kind of already told you that. And one of the sources talks about how size isn't necessarily all of the picture. You have to consider weight and force as well, which, yeah, I mean, I could throw a baseball at Tiff and break her nose and cheekbone and maybe her orbit in one fell swoop, you know? If she's standing there, an immovable object, and I just whip around and drill a baseball at her, I mean, it's going to cause damage. I'm not going to. Don't worry. I'm not going to.
Thank you. I don't want to have a Marsha Brady moment.
Well, that would be great. It wouldn't be great, but I could just picture you.
Oh, my nose.
Wait, you got to muffle it.
Oh, no.
There goes my date with Doug.
Yeah.
But it's estimated that even at that relatively modest 16-foot size, coming down that incline, it would have been around 25 pounds per cubic foot pressure. That's pretty nasty, y'all. One source notes that it's entirely possible that after they cut open the tent just to get the hell out of there once they realized shit was going down, that they drug out the more severely injured and tried to get them into some sort of shelter. Like how, remember we talked about me saying it would make sense that the ones in that kind of crevasse area were more injured? Because my thought process was they're weakened anyway. And so if they had trouble getting down there, maybe they got bunged up along the way. And maybe they did. Maybe they did get banged up. But it could be that those injuries were primarily from the slide coming down if those were the people towards the back of the tent. And then those who were more mobile got them settled turned back to try to get what supplies they could. Because again, they were, some of them almost literally caught with their pants down, like Tiff told you. Some of them were in long johns, socks, or what did you,
It was total disarray. It was just...
Yeah, what all did you say? Like, some of them had, like, moccasin type, or, like, ski socks?
They had layers of socks, just their pajamas, you know, long johns, maybe a jacket. It's just...
Just random.
It's all over the place. They were not dressed for the weather, you know, for being outside and having to actually do anything.
Yeah, clear chaos. So maybe they were going back to get what supplies they could, planning to return to the more injured. Or could be that they put them there to at least give them a fighting chance to be kind and not leave them to potentially be crushed by more avalanche, like as in leaving them in the tent, not knowing if more snow was about to come down. It could be that they realized these folks were bad off, but you're going to try and survive. You're not just going to sit there with them and die yourself. You know, that's just, so that could be. Maybe the intent was to return to them, but maybe they realized there's such a limited amount that we can do. And if we are to survive, we can't just hunker down with them in this crevasse and keep our fingers crossed. As a matter of fact, check this out. It was discovered that they had buried a little supply cache in the forest. So this explains why some of them were so far away. Quoting Gom, you start to cut the tent from the inside to get out. You see that there was an avalanche, and then you might be afraid of a second avalanche. And so they may have decided that the best option would be to go to the forest, make a fire, and try to find that supply. So there we go. That tracks for me, explaining, because wasn't two of the guys just were hell and gone from the campsite, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. So there was the campsite, and then they had to go across the little valley there to get to the tree line. And there were some people right by the trees. There were some a little bit further down. And then, like you said, kind of by the crevasse.
For me, knowing now that they had a supply cache, that makes sense why the hell they were going in that direction. It was just weird. So, okay, that kind of explains that. And then they did do models of their theory about the injuries as well. They simulated different sizes of snow blocks coming down at that angle and distance onto the tent. And they adjusted for force and pressure because one other little factoid that I've yet to share, to save room, they were all sleeping atop their skis. So tent, floor, tent bottom, you know, canvas bottom, skis, then sleeping bags, basically is what they'd done. And it's here that I wonder if this couldn't also be an explanation for the girl who it looked like she had quote unquote baton mark beatings on her body. Because what if they also had, and I imagine they did, why would they leave this one item out in the snow if their ski poles were in the tent? Not to say that they were sleeping atop them, that would be bizarre to me, but just in there and you've got that crushing coming down on you. It's not like you can suddenly change position, but it pushed them. It could push them into items. It could push items into them. Just another thing to think about. So now there you go. There's your force against a hard surface versus maybe if they were in sleeping bags atop just canvas bottom of the tent over snow. That snow maybe would have had some give to it, perhaps. And what they did was they used crash test results from automotive tests to do this because if anybody listening didn't know, yeah, they do use crash test dummies, but they also use, or at least they did use, I have not checked this in recent past, but corpses. And I cannot recommend the book Stiff by Mary Roach enough. If you want to learn more about this and many other things about the quote-unquote lives of corpses, it is a fantastic read. She is a wonderful writer. We're not getting paid for this. It is one of my favorite books of all time. It is. Legit.
It is a really good book.
Here's the thing about this book. She will not gross you out. I don't know how she managed to do it, but she tells you all these stories about what happens to people after they die. And it will not gross you out. It's amazing. She's wonderful. Okay, moving on. Then we know the rest. They talk about the state of their clothing, and Tiff covered that. I mean, they were ready for bed, but the ones who were in little clothing, that could be paradoxical undressing, or the ones that had weird, bizarre, like you said, doubled up socks and stuff like that, could be that they started splitting up what they had to give the ones who were least injured the most chance. I mean, hell if I know. But I'm just not, the clothing stuff is not a sticking point for me as far as something that's just this, ooh, mystery. I will say, though, they pointed out something I didn't think of. Talking about the radioactive material detected on some of the clothing, Tiff talked about how one of the guys worked with nuclear materials, but also, check this out, one of the sources made a good point, and it was that this could have come from thorium. And thorium is a radioactive material, and it happened to be in their lanterns. I tried to do a nice little condensed explanation of it for you, but I failed. So just understand, it's a radioactive substance that has no business being in lanterns, but it was the 1950s. That's the best explanation I can give you.
Well, ain't that some shit?
How you like them apples? Somewhat related in the sense of stuff that shouldn't have been in that tent in the first place. I also still submit that being in an enclosed space with a freaking homemade stove was not a great idea. I stand by that. I do. I think it possibly could have added to their shock being slightly loopy from carbon monoxide, but that's impossible to prove. I know it. But y'all, please, please don't fire up homemade appliances in general.
You have major issues with the stove. I remember this from the first recording, too.
Just don't do it. Don't make you a home. Just quit. Yeah, quit. Just buy the stuff, y'all. Just buy it. Save up some money and just buy it. It is, don't make homemade space heaters. Don't do all this. Don't do it in an enclosed space. Just God almighty. Okay, so where does Frozen fit in? Well, Gom had seen it. But like me, he was not impressed by the story and the characters. Instead, he zeroed in on that realistic avalanche and snow pile and wind animation. Gom decides that in order to really demonstrate what he and Pooshren are driving at, they needed to punch up their code. So he contacts good old Walt Disney. I mean, you know, not Disney. He gone. I mean, the company. Specifically, the animators who were part of the Frozen team and asked if they wanted to do some science. They were like, yes. So Gom ends up going out to California, and they came through big time. He is given the relevant parts of the animation code to go with their math and see if they were right. If given the angle of the slope and how much and where the campers cut into it, if given the wind and the piling of the snow from higher altitudes, what size clump would this have produced? And would that clump, coupled with the established parameters, been of significant proportion to result in the campers' injuries? And hey, guess what? We say all of this to say, did Frozen solve the mystery, as has been the title of numerous articles and videos and whatnot? No. Science solved the mystery, and code from the brilliant computer graphic animators helped create the model based on mathematical calculations, plus knowledge of avalanche patterns. But I'm slightly misspeaking here, because is the mystery totally solved? Also, no. While this is pretty robust as far as theories go, the events of Dyatlov Pass really can't be definitively resolved because there's no eyewitnesses or footage, of course. Says Gom, quote, "I want to be clear that we do not claim that we solved the mystery. I mean, no one wants this mystery to be solved in Russia. This is part of the Russian lore. People don't want it to be an avalanche. It's just too normal." And related to what people think, it's pointed out in one of my sources that another thing that goes around is that the campers were just stupid and taking risks and blah, 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 victim blaming. Pooshren talks about how this isn't a fair assessment because the study shows that, quote, "This freak avalanche would have surprised mountaineering experts with a lifetime of experience. The Dyatlov team members were very competent people who would never have foreseen the danger of clearing a space for their tent on what looked like a gentle slope." And that is your follow-up on Dyatlov. And like I said, check out the sources and show notes. A couple of them show parts of the simulation. And I'm also sticking a link in there for you that'll take you to the study if you want to read it in full.
That's wonderful. I like that there's a follow-up.
Me too.
I mean, you know, we still don't know what happened. We kind of know what happened. But yeah, no, that's interesting. It's really cool how technology just fucking trucks along like that and can do things.
And I like these guys because they, here's how it reads to me, that they had done their little computer simulations on like an Atari and realized this wouldn't sell anybody. This isn't going to sell a soul. It doesn't matter how much we've drilled down on this in our write-up. This has got to be a banger to really get people to sit up and take notice. And I just love that probably this guy's child or niece or nephew or whoever, he had been tortured to no end having to watch that stupid movie over and over again. He's probably singing that song in his sleep. And then it hits him. Huh, you know, if I use some of that with some of my science, I just bless his heart. I feel sympathy for all y'all parents. Like, I know how much I was tired and currently still am tired of hearing about Frozen. I can't fathom what it was like for y'all parents.
Oh, it was a lot. It's still a lot. Although, my boys are getting older, and so they're starting to be like, oh, princess, no. And so now we kind of use it as almost like a torture tactic. If one of them's starting to be a little too sassy, we'll be like, oh, I guess it's time to watch Frozen then, isn't it?
Let me tell you something. I would break. There's some stuff that I think, you know what? I think I could, like, psychological torture-wise, I think to myself, I could hold out for a decent bit. Barring any unforeseens, all things being equal, that I hadn't been subjected to something horrific immediately prior. You know, I feel like I could get through the initial stages of it at least. But I tell you what, all they'd have to do is put Frozen on a loop and stick it in my cell. And I'd be like, I'll tell you everything. What do you want to know? I'll tell you family secrets. I'll tell you whatever you want. That movie works my nerve. I cannot articulate. I'm not going to either. This episode's long enough. But hey, if you also do not care for Frozen, please let me know. If you perhaps pretended to like Frozen for the benefit of others, I will be here for you. You feel free to write in. You can do it anonymously at the blog and just consider me your priest and that this is your confession. And I'll give you, I'm not Catholic. What would I give them?
Absolution.
5 Hail Elsas and a... I don't know.
We went to Disneyland the year after that movie was out. Like everything there, everything was all Frozen and crazy. They had a little special little like Frozen land area kind of thing and put on these little shows. And we left Wisconsin and it was the end of January. And we're like, yeah, we're going to go to California. It's going to be nice. They had a whole section where they had like this fake indoor wonderland with fake snow for sledding and snowball fights. I'm like, I left this to come to a better place. And here you are. Forcing me to be in this building full of snow. God damn it.
I was about to say, you're a Yankee. So you are used to the Frozen is your life. You live it.
Yeah. We had snow flurries the other day. The other day.
Are you kidding?
It is May. It is May in the year 2021. And we had snow flurries.
And, you know, take comfort in this, too. If climate change isn't real, it's a hoax.
Oh, yeah.
Why not snow in May? That's natural.
What was that? Oh, who was that? Vanessa Williams? Sometimes the snow comes down in June. Don't you remember that? Oh, what was it? Save the best for last.
I remember it well. Oh, yeah. I love that. I wore that cassette single out, baby. I love that. Hey, there's a song about snow I can get behind. Again, Let It Go is not a bad song. I'm just saying if I heard it on repeat, I would pull my hair out.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
All right.
That's all I'm saying.
But hey, Frozen solved the mystery.
It did not solve the mystery. If anybody takes anything away from this, Elsa, with her whimsical PMS driven, inexplicable, don't have no reason for it powers, did not solve the mystery of the DIY campers. She didn't. I'm sorry.
That would have been a better movie.
That's the okay.
Someone make that movie.
Okay. A little grim for Disney, the bodies, but maybe they could be helpful little spirits guiding Elsa to the clues. I don't know. I don't have the answers. I don't.
I mean, they kill parents in every movie. Why can't they just find some bodies?
That's fair.
Hollywood, come a knockin'. I'm ready.
That's the Frozen 3 that we're looking for. Or has there already been 3? I know there's been Frozen 2. Okay, well, there you go, Hollywood. There's Frozen 3. Frozen 3, Russia Adventure. Mary Roach could be a consultant for how to appropriately animate the corpses. And this is awful. We're awful people. We're awful. And so we're saying goodbye.
This is where the catchphrase goes.
Woo!
Thanks for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at our blog, along with any other supplemental things we think you might enjoy. Just head over to youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com, and in the menu, click on show notes.
We're also on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. You can contact us at any of those places, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.
We love hearing from you, whether it's ideas for episodes, your own personal or family stories, telling us what we can do better, and telling us what we should keep on doing.
And if you're enjoying the podcast, please consider taking a moment to rate and review on your platform of choice. Or if you know someone who may like our content, send them our way.
We're so grateful for our listeners and would love to add even more people to our wild podcast family.